Good morning and welcome to the November term of court for the South Dakota Supreme Court held here on the campus of Dakota Westland in Mitchell. We have several publications available in the lobby which you might wish to avail yourself. They're all free. The first one with our seal on the cover, kind of a gray cover, tells you a little bit about each one of the justices and also tells you a little bit about each one of the oral argument cases that we will be hearing during this term. The second publication is also gray. It has our picture on the cover, and this is a brief pictorial history of the South Dakota Supreme Court. And the third publication available is the blue one with the gold seal, and this is a written narrative of how the South Dakota Supreme Court functions and decides its cases that are brought to it on appeal. The court would also like to welcome this morning high school students from Gregory High School, Plankington High School, Sioux Falls Christian High School, James Valley Christian High School, and Mitchell Technical Institute. The first case for oral argument this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Uriah Tullis. For the appellant, Uriah Tullis is Mr. Gregory Graycheck, an attorney from Milbank, and for the appellee, State of South Dakota, is Mr. Grant Gormley, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Graycheck, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I am thrilled to be here today in the heart of this academic environment to discuss with the court certain fundamental civil liberties. The first and only issue that this court really need address in this case is the error the circuit court made in denying the motion to suppress the unquestionably invalid search of the Brad Hall residence. This is a Fourth Amendment social host case. Uriah Tullis, a close personal friend of Brad Hall, the lessee for many years, was an invited guest at Brad Hall's home on March 10, 2003. It's interesting to note at the start that Brad Hall, the lessee of the premises, who actually purchased the methamphetamines in question in this case, who actually invited Uriah Tullis to his home for social engagement, who actually went and picked Mr. Tullis up and brought him to his home for this social interaction, and whose angry girlfriend actually turned him in for using drugs, is a free man today. Yet his best friend sits in prison because his rights were deemed to be somehow less important. The unfairness of this result is probably a good cross-check as to the incorrect Fourth Amendment analysis that was utilized by the circuit court. The appropriate analysis, the substantive Fourth Amendment analysis in this case, begins with the review of the legitimate expectation of privacy, or the unreasonable, or the reasonable expectation of privacy. Those terms are used in case law, it appears, interchangeably, legitimate in the federal courts and reasonable in the state courts.
For the benefit of the audience, could you go through like a minute or two of facts so they can understand what sets this case before the court?
Certainly, Your Honor. This case arose March 10th when Uriah Tullis was invited over to the house of Brad Hall to drive around in go-karts that morning. Prior to engaging in this activity, they entered the residence and began what is arguably the consumption of methamphetamines. At that time, the law enforcement officers showed up at the door with a search warrant in hand in order to search the premises and, in fact, search the bodily fluids of Brad Hall, the resident. This warrant was received by the officer based on false information given to Judge Tim, who issued the warrant, and was found to be false by Judge Rohr, who heard the motion to suppress in the Brad Hall case. The false information indicated that there were activities going on the day the warrant was issued and served, which actually were not occurring that day, but it occurred the day before or more days prior. Judge Rohr found that because of the incorrect or false information provided to Judge Tim, the warrant was invalid. and in fact was suppressed as to Brad Hall. Uriah Tullis was arrested as part of the search, was taken to the detention center, and against his wishes, his express rejection, his bodily fluids were seized and tested and used by the state in the criminal proceeding. In the social context, and in the social host arena, which is what we are addressing here today, there are certain absolute parameters of that issue, and arguably a gray area in the middle. There is no longer any question that somebody who resides in the premises overnight, one night, is absolutely entitled to a Fourth Amendment shield. There's likewise no question that a door-to-door salesman who shows up, the kind of the foot-in-the-door invitation to the premises, while legitimately there, has no expectation of privacy in the premises. In between those two parameters is the arguable gray area. However, this issue has been explored in depth by the United States Supreme Court in the case of Minnesota versus Carter. And as pointed out by this court in State v. Hess, the analysis should pay careful attention to Justice Kennedy's concurrence, as his decision rests in the middle of two plurality positions. Justice Ginsburg, with three justices, concurring, reads the Fourth Amendment as it is actually written, that virtually anyone on the premises by invitation is shielded by the Fourth Amendment from police state tactics. Chief Justice Rehnquist, with three justices concurring, finds that certain relationships are entitled to different qualities of Fourth Amendment protection, the parameters of which are yet to be defined. However, Justice Kennedy, in his concurrence, made it clear that in the type of case we're addressing, there is no longer any question where the Fourth Amendment parameters lie. He stated that, "I would expect that most, if not all, social guests legitimately expect that, in accordance with social custom, the homeowner will exercise her discretion to include or exclude others for the guest's benefit. As recognized in Olson, these social expectations exist, as in the overnight guest case, and they are sufficient to create a legitimate expectation of privacy, even in the absence of any property rights to exclude others. In this respect, the dissent must be correct, that reasonable expectations of the owner are shared to some extent by the guest." He therefore concludes, "This analysis suggests that, as a general rule, social host will have an expectation of privacy in their host home." This case deals exactly with that type of situation. Uriah Tullis, Brad Hall's best friend, appears before him, or it comes with him to his residence for the purpose of social interaction. Brad Hall,
there'd be no time limit on that if you're simply invited over for a brief period of time. You're a social host, is that what you're saying? It's not a time question, it's a identity issue, a social host, no matter the length of time.
I would contend that that's what case law is teaching us today. That's what Justice Kennedy's argument or position reflects, that the social relationship is adequate by itself to extend Fourth Amendment protection to those invited to the residence. However, we need not tally there long, because in this case, we don't have that case of short duration, short relationship, distance between the guest and the host. Brad Hall was the best friend of Uriah Tullis for many years, had been for many years. They grew up together, had been friends for a long time.
There seemed to be some dispute in the evidence, as to those basic facts and so forth, and as to what extent he was a social guest. What testimony supports your argument there? Did Brad Hall testify?
Brad Hall provided an affidavit to the court at the time of suppression, which the court did not consider. He did not provide other testimony because Judge Rohr refused to allow him to do so at the reconsideration hearing, although Brad Hall was available at that time. The plethora of information or testimony on this issue really makes Brad Hall's testimony duplicative, really. Even Judge Rohr, who did not believe much of Brad Hall's or Uriah Tullis's testimony, conceded that Uriah Tullis and Brad Hall had been friends for many years, that Uriah Tullis had stayed at Brad Hall's home many times. He disagreed or disbelieved the number of times testified to by Mr. Tullis, but he agreed, yeah, I mean, he stayed there many times. The record has abundant information about Tullis's relationship to Brad Hall. Mr. Tullis watched his children for him, some occasions overnight when Mr. Hall was gone working.
And who testified to that?
Mr. Tullis testified to it, as well as the state's witness, Tina Hall, who was the sister of Brad Hall, testified that Uriah Tullis babysat his children at least on one occasion she's aware of overnight. Uriah Tullis testified that he watched the children more often than that, but depends on who you believe, it really doesn't matter because he clearly was comfortable enough with Uriah Tullis to leave his children with him at least overnight. Uriah Tullis was at the residence off and on. Uriah Tullis kept clothes at the house because he changed there periodically. Uriah Tullis contributed to the grocery bill because he stayed there enough, he felt compelled to contribute money to the grocery bill. All of these factors point to a substantial relationship.
Did the trial court accept those factors?
The trial court did not reject those factors. The only factors the trial court really rejected in his finding was he disagreed with the extent of the overnight stays. That's the only thing that the trial court actually rejected.
And that was the testimony from a woman, I believe, correct?
That would be Tina Hall's testimony. He accepted her testimony over Mr. Tullis's testimony, although if you carefully read the record, you would find that the two don't necessarily conflict, at least not to a significant degree. But regardless, it's clear this is not an insubstantial, or is not an insubstantial relationship. It's clearly a substantial, long-term friendship. And all of the cases that address relationship in the social host context place this case squarely on the side of individuals entitled to protection under the Fourth Amendment.
Well, then tell me this. Did the trial court, in your view, go awry based on its view of the facts or on its application of Carter and Olson and Hess?
I believe the trial court went awry in a misapplication of the law. The trial court, for whatever reason, bought the state's argument that the purpose of the visit forfeited Fourth Amendment rights. However, the Supreme Court has rejected that basis for rejecting or for forfeiting rights because under that analysis, anyone who gathers in a private place to commit a crime would be without Fourth Amendment rights. Such a forfeiture would apply to the homeowner himself, and that's clearly not the law in this nation. The trial court, for whatever reason, determined that because they gathered for the purpose of using drugs socially, that purpose was not something society was willing to accept.
Well, but however, the Supreme Court has said that you can't, that you don't have this expectation if you go to the premises to use drugs.
No, the Supreme Court has not said that. The only thing the Supreme Court has said that if you're there for commercial purposes, if you're there to conduct business, that is one factor that would possibly restrict your right to an expectation of privacy. However, it is not simply the commercial nature that applies. There also must be a lack of substantive contacts. There are numerous cases subsequent to Carter in which commercial ventures are actually upheld an expectation of privacy because there is a substantial connection between the host and the guest. I would point to the case of State v. Moss out of Minnesota. The individual there had been selling cocaine out of a residence for over a month. In addition to selling cocaine, he was sleeping with the homeowner. The court found that that was a substantial relationship, and as such, he's entitled to an expectation of privacy, regardless of the fact that his nature of contact was predominantly to sell drugs. The court did not get into the question of whether or not a month's stay at the home is adequate time to even grant an expectation of privacy to a commercial venture, focusing instead on the connection between the host and the guest. And all the cases that deal with the social host arena look to the connection between the host and the guest to determine if there is a substantial connection. If the substantial connection exists, then they're entitled to Fourth Amendment protection. If it doesn't exist, then you look to the other factors that the Supreme Court set out in the Carter case. But the Carter case focused predominantly, even the majority opinion focused predominantly on the issue of the commercial nature of the transaction. In that case, they were there for only a couple hours, had never been there before. There was no showing that they even had any connection to the person whose premises it was prior to going there. And they used the premises for the sole purpose of cutting drugs to sell. And under those circumstances, the Supreme Court majority or plurality said that's not a substantial contact to the premises, therefore they have no rights. Justice Kennedy found that that's consistent with his belief that all social hosts have standing or protection under the Fourth Amendment because there was no connection between the premises, the host, the guest, to give, in that case, an expectation of privacy to this commercial venture.
So let me ask you this. When I look at Judge Rohr's writing on this, he says that Tullis had the subjective expectation of privacy. However, it's not one which society accepts as reasonable in the second part of it. And if I'm understanding what you're saying is that it's this second part that society doesn't accept as reasonable where the court went wrong.
That's correct, Your Honor. That ruling is based on the state's argument to Judge Rohr that because they gathered for the purpose of committing a crime, that forfeits the Fourth Amendment protection. However, Justice Ginsburg, in her concurrence, made a clear statement of rejecting that analysis for sensible reasons. If the illegality of the activity made constitutional, if the illegality of the activity made constitutional an otherwise unconstitutional search, such Fourth Amendment protection reserved for the innocent only would have little force in regulating police behavior towards either the innocent or the guilty. Clearly, if the police need only show a crime occurred in order to void Fourth Amendment protections, there would be no Fourth Amendment protections. And that is not the way the Fourth Amendment is intended to be analyzed. I would point out, in response to Chief Justice Gilbertson's question earlier about the time issue, in the social host context, I think it's interesting to look at the case of in re the matter of BRK. Again, a Minnesota case. The facts of that case are particularly short-lived. The young man in question, Mr. BRK, a juvenile, appeared at a party on his own. He crashed the party, showed up. He was there for a short period of time. Indication was that police were going to be called. All the sensible kids left. Mr. BRK stayed with the host to watch TV for a short period afterwards. In that case, the Minnesota Supreme Court said his clear expectation of privacy, they closed the doors, they locked the windows to make sure that they weren't disturbed, and his acceptance by the host there for the social interaction to watch TV were the factors necessary to prove an expectation of privacy, and that's all that was necessary to prove an expectation of privacy. In fact, the Minnesota Supreme Court felt so strongly about the need to extend Fourth Amendment protections to this circumstance that they went on to rule that even if their Fourth Amendment analysis stretched too far, that their state constitution would grant that protection in this case and prevent the police from storming into a house uninvited without warrant.
Are you going to address the due process issue just in case your standing issue does not come?
And you have 2 minutes to do it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I can't address the due process issue briefly. There is a question on the search warrant itself. The seizure of urine, I should say, that was made. This court has addressed that issue. A couple of times, we do contend that that resolution was incorrect. It failed to give appropriate consideration to the term exigency. It seems that the court has adopted an expedient definition of exigency rather than an emergency definition of exigency, and that is where the appropriate consideration should lie. On the question of due process, there is an issue of lenity that should apply, and it's particularly appropriate in this case to consider that, because in criminal cases, it's clearly improper to introduce evidence of one crime to prove another crime. However, because the statutes have so confused the division between possession and ingestion of drugs, one crime is being used repeatedly to prove another crime. And the person being charged is left with wondering, well, one's a misdemeanor, one's a felony, you know, where do my rights lie? You know, clearly an ingestion crime is a misdemeanor crime. A possession crime is a felony crime. But if the use of drugs or the ingestion of drugs is the evidence that is used to get the conviction, that would be a violation of due process rights, because the ambiguity statutes are being used against the accused when the proper analysis requires that lenity apply and the lower charge control over the higher charge.
Your time has expired, Mr. Graycheck. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Gormley, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I want to start out by saying what we have to determine here are the facts of this case. I don't think we're going to have a dispute as to the legal principles, but we have to decide the facts. What's been presented to you as the facts aren't in the case. They're not in the record. The only facts that exist in this record are that this defendant was found in the trailer. We know that. They caught him there. We also know on the facts that he was there to do drugs. The only other thing we know is that he didn't spend the previous night there, so he wasn't an overnight guest. That's the end of the facts. There are no other facts in this record.
However, the Judge Ruhr does say that he stayed overnight on the couch at Hall residence and occasionally ate meals there. Where did that come from?
I have no idea. What's in the record that are the facts? I know where it might have come from. I'm not sure. If you look at the appellant's brief, Appendix B, there is a letter in there from Judge Rohr where he says a lot of things. That letter is not in the record. It was never made a part of the record. What's in the record are three pages of the settled record, the findings of fact of Judge Rohr, pages 111, 112, and 13, and none of this stuff that's being presented to you was in that record. That's all we know.
Well, what was presented at the submission?
There was testimony about, from the defendant saying, I came there to drive go-karts. It's not in the findings of the court. There's testimony about how he took care of children. They're not there in the findings of the court. And I can go on and on down the list.
Well, there was testimony. It's just that it's not incorporated in the court's findings. There are facts in the record.
There are statements in the record, and the judge did not include them in his findings, and the judge, in comparing the testimony of Tina Hall, the sister of the guy who owned the trailer or lived in the trailer, and the defendant, said, we have divergent testimony here, and I believe Tina Hall. He basically, in those findings, said he believed Tina Hall, therefore finding the defendant's testimony not to be credible. He never in his findings says that anything that the defendant said was credible. On a couple of occasions in those findings, he says the defendant testified as follows, but he does not say, the judge does not say, and I adopt what he testified. There is no There are no facts in that record to support the suggestion that's being made here.
Well, would the testimony of Tina Hall establish some facts to show that he was a social guest?
I don't believe that the facts that Tina Hall established that. My recollection is that Tina Hall said, I never saw him there. And he said, I was there every other day. And Tina Hall said, I was there every other day. And they said, well, maybe you were there on the every other days, that he wasn't there on the every other days. That's what they came up with. I don't think Tina Hall testifies that that we can establish that he's a social guest. The whole issue here, I suppose, will be to what extent he was a social guest, and there just isn't anything here to make him a social guest. This isn't anything like the Hess case, where we have a boyfriend and he stayed overnight and he has a place there and so on. The only thing that the judge says even remotely close in the findings is he mentions in passing that the defendant says he kept some clothes there. But again, the judge doesn't say whether he believed that. He just says apparently he must have kept all his other clothes somewhere else. So there aren't any facts in this record to support the proposition that's being made here. And that's what's crucial to the case. Now, maybe if somebody goes back and they want to develop a record and develop that some of these things are true, that would be fine. But the only testimony here in this case basically is from the defendant, and the judge doesn't give any indication that he believed what he had to say.
Is a remand of this case a possible remedy?
It's a possible remedy, and that would be one way to get some information in the record to support what's being said here. But of course, if it is a possible remedy, hopefully then the state, which it did not do the first time, will bring up the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, which basically takes care of this anyway.
Well, now, I'm not clear on the good faith exception. Now that you brought it up, why don't we just go to that for a moment? I thought I read in the briefs that the trial judge did make some comment about good faith not applying here.
What was said in the brief, in the reply brief by the defendant, was that the judge said there was not good faith. But the judge they're talking about is the judge in the other case, in the judge in the Brad Hall case, not the judge in this case. This judge, if we look at the findings and conclusions, never made any such statement at all, and never made any statement of any kind as to why it would have been a bad faith situation if it was.
Did the state raise that argument below?
The state does not raise the argument below, but I don't believe it has to, Your Honor. I would argue to you that it doesn't. I'm well aware of the State versus Don Jackson case, where this court had a specific case like this, and the court said that because something was not presented to the trial court, we're going to decline to consider it here. But that language was basically in a footnote, and it was dictum. In that particular case, this court said there's probable cause, and therefore there's not a problem with the search warrant. But in a footnote, we mentioned that the state also raised this issue of good faith exception, hadn't brought it up below, and we declined to consider it. Now, I don't know if that should be taken as we will never consider it under any circumstances, but I would argue against that. First of all, this was dictum, and therefore I don't think it's binding. But furthermore, we have an entirely different situation here. In that case, this court cited a Colorado case, an Iowa case, and a South Dakota case. And in every one of those cases, the state lost down below on the probable cause issue. And if the state loses down below, then the state ought to be bringing up the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule to the trial court so it has an opportunity to consider that. But that's not what happened here. In this case, the state won down below. And I would argue it would make no sense for the state, when it has a winning case, to bring up an argument that says, suppose if we have a losing case, we'd like to bring up something else when we've already won.
How do you know that? I mean, when you're presenting your case, you don't know if you're going to win or lose.
Well, I consider that to be first of all, I think most attorneys down there would say, I've got some vibes about how this thing is going to go, because they're sitting there listening to the argument they made the judge. But even if that's not the case, if the defendant had raised an issue down below and lost, and then decided before trial to bring it up and raise another claim as a part of it, I'm sure the court would let him reopen the case. And I suspect the court down below would let the state reopen a case to bring up an argument that it failed to bring up previously if it ended up losing. I mean, it just, the thing is that all I can think of is William F. Buckley running for the mayor of New York City with absolutely no chance of winning. And they asked him before the vote, what are you going to do if you win? And he said, ask for a recount. And that's just about what this is. We think we've got a standing issue that we think we win. They presented no evidence on. The prosecutor is absolutely confident for whatever reason of this, and does win. And so it just doesn't seem that the state would have to say, well, you know, we're sure we're going to win, but just in case we don't win, we'd like to bring up something else and give the court some reason to believe we don't think we have a good argument on the merits of the standing issue.
Was the good faith issue raised in the Hall case?
I don't know that.
Wouldn't that be important for us to know?
Well, yes and no. The only thing that bothers me about that is that there's no indication of the judge in this case dealing with what happened with the Hall case. The judge did say, I'm finding in this case that there was not valid probable cause for the search warrant. He did say that much, but that's all he said, and that's where he left it. So even if the Hall, let's assume, and I don't know it to be the case, I didn't see it in the record, let's assume the judge in the Hall case rejected that. That's the Hall case. This is this case. In the Hall case, they wouldn't have been able to claim that they didn't have standing. You know, that Hall had standing to raise the, so he wouldn't need the good faith exception. Well, the state might if it lost on the standing issue, I suppose. But that was a different judge. It was a different case. This is this case and this judge. I don't think that this judge is bound by that, and he certainly never said that he was or said anything in his findings about concluding that there was any bad faith here. And I didn't look at the Hall case, because I looked at what was in the record that was sent to me when I wrote my brief, and then after this case was set for oral argument, I asked to look at the file again. And there was nothing about the Hall case in the file that I saw that this court had.
Well, evidently, though, as at least some part of it, the fact that the search warrant was found, the probable cause issue isn't tried in this case. The search warrant was not even addressed, was it?
Well, the judge did say in his findings that the search warrant was not good.
So evidently he had access to the Hall case, or at least the parties stipulated to that.
In the case, there was a third person in this trailer, and the third person was being tried along with this defendant, and that person's attorney said, I want to include the Hall case stuff in this record. And the judge agreed with that. But it's not in the record that I saw, and wasn't in the record that the court had, unless it has it by now. It didn't have it a month ago after it set this for oral argument. In this case, in the findings of fact, this court found that the search warrant in the Hall case was not based upon probable cause and ordered that the evidence seized on the warrant be suppressed. So this court did find that much. It just didn't find any good faith. And I would argue, even though what's in the appendix that they've attached is not part of the record, presumably what is part of the record is what they attach, and that's the request for the search warrant. It was a telephonic request, a phone call made to Judge Tim. And they, in that case, the person that the police had talked to is the, we'll say, girlfriend and mother of the children who was living with Brad Hall. This is not a confidential, unnamed informant that no one knows. This, according to what was presented to the judge and to the cop presented, it was directly, they directly observed the illegality. They said they're doing the meth right now out of a hollowed out light bulb, that this guy purchased an 8-ball of meth for $325 from the cities. They had the address of the place. It seems to me, first of all, we have this, this isn't a case of a request for a search warrant being made to somebody who's a magistrate that isn't law trained. This is a circuit court judge. Involved in this conversation was the policeman, but also involved in the conversation was the state's attorney. So I'm a policeman and I'm presenting this information to a circuit court judge, and a circuit court judge and my state's attorney seem to think this is all right, that this is sufficient for probable cause, and I, as a cop, am supposed to say to myself, well, I know that this is bad faith and that none of this is true and that this is an invalid search warrant. That just can't be the case. On the face of this, it would appear to me, based on what is in the record in that telephone call that was made to get the search warrant, it appears like the search warrant's just fine. I have no idea why the judge in the other case said it wasn't. But it's certainly not bad faith on the part of this cop to think that that was a good search warrant.
Would you address the due process issue? Because that was not raised in the other case where we dealt with that statute, the ingestion, and as opposed to the felony.
Sure. Well, this one seems awfully easy to me. The problem, again, are the facts, and that is that the judge believed the cop and didn't believe the defendant. The cop said, I asked for the 3 hours after the fact, I asked for the urine sample, the guy said he wouldn't give it to me, I told him he had to, so he gave it to me. And then there's all this stuff about sticking a cup under the stream of pee and a bunch of stuff that doesn't make any sense. I don't know who in the world would do that in the first place, and in the second place, the judge didn't agree with it. So we have a search warrant, and it was taken incident to a lawful arrest, and you have to have probable cause. The guy ran from the cops. He threw a syringe behind the drawer. He had meth and marijuana that was in the place. There was a hollowed out light bulb in the place. There was a digital scale, a straw, a lighter. It seems to me there's plenty of probable cause for them to do this. The evidence is a reliable method and taken in a reasonable manner. The judge believed the cop that the guy, in fact, gave him the sample after the cop told him, you have to give it to me. So all that leaves is exigent circumstances, and I would say this court already decided that in Hansen and Buchholz, and basically said that drugs and alcohol are the same, and urine and blood are treated the same, and that there's sufficient circumstances of dissipation here, and therefore you can do this. So it seems to me like...
Was there evidence in this record about how quickly meth leaves the body and where that was in the sequence of the time that the urine sample was taken?
I do not remember that. The only thing I know in this record is it said the sample was taken about 3 hours after the arrest. But it's within time frames talked about in the previous cases, and the previous cases saying that's not dispositive of it. So I, in my mind, it's a simple issue. I mean, the police did everything right. It's something they can do. They had probable cause to do it. The circumstances were sufficient under the law of this that this court has established in two recent cases. Basically, end of story.
How would you respond to an argument that if the search was invalid, that the collection of this evidence was fruit of the poisonous tree?
If the search warrant was invalid and if the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule does not apply and the state loses on the first issue, I have a hard time seeing how the state's going to win on. Okay. I mean, if we lose on the first issue, we got a reversal already, I would think. So I don't know what to tell you. If it was a bad search warrant and there was absolutely no way that the cop did the right thing and he knew in bad faith that it was a bad search warrant, none of which I think is true, then I don't know how it couldn't be fruit of the poisonous tree. But I don't think you get there because in the first issue, unless they go back and establish some facts, that would change things. You never have to get to the second issue stands because the first issue stands. And I think you can do like you did in Sorenson, you can go to the good faith issue, skip the search warrant part of it, and just go to the... Pardon me?
You have 2 minutes, Counsel.
I really don't have more to say unless there are further questions. I stand with the brief on the other issues that haven't been discussed.
Thank you, Mr. Gormley.
Thank you.
Mr. Graycheck, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's at least encouraging to hear the state act with or to express incredulity at the method of taking urine in this case. However, let's move on to first the question of good faith. It's interesting to me that the state tells the court we got a different judge, different case, so we can't consider the last case. First and foremost, Judge Rohr heard the suppression motion in this case. Judge Rohr heard the suppression motion in the Brad Hall case. And the simple fact of the matter is the state at trial did not bring up the issue of good faith because Judge Rohr made it plain and clear in his ruling that there is no such thing as good faith in this case. It's clear the officer acted on false information. Judge Rohr specifically so found. The transcript, which I believe was part of this record, at least it was asked to be part of this record, Judge Rohr specifically states, in the absence of false statements, the bare bones, uncorroborated oral statement does not provide probable cause. Judge
what page
Rohr,
is that? What
page this is page 27 of the transcript. Judge Rohr goes on to state on page 28, in the present case, this court finds, considering the bare bones nature of the statement and the false statements it contained, that using an objective standard, a reasonably well-trained officer would have known that a search was illegal, despite the judge's authorization. Consequently, the requirement of the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule have not been met. Clearly, Judge Rohr addressed the issue of good faith. Clearly, he rejected it, and clearly, he rejected on the appropriate basis that the officer had information that he falsely presented to the judge in order to secure the warrant. That is a clear basis for rejecting an officer's standing or basis of good faith. It has consistently been a basis for rejecting good faith. And as the United States Supreme Court said, suppression remains an appropriate remedy if the judge in issuing a warrant was misled by information in an affidavit that the affiant knew was false or would have known was false, except for his reckless disregard for the truth.
So you are conceding the issue of good faith is before us because it was preserved below.
No, Your Honor. You know, I find it also incredulous that the state would argue that this court will address the issue not raised below. This court has consistently held in both civil and criminal cases, if the issue is not preserved in the court below, it will not be considered in this court for any reason. There's a good reason for that. The issue has not been addressed, it hasn't been developed, the facts haven't been presented, sufficient for the court to make an appropriate decision. Good faith was not preserved by the state, and in this case, I point out to you, there's a reason it wasn't preserved by the state, because the state knew there was no good faith in this case, and therefore, it was not addressed.
Why did Judge Rohr rule on it then?
Excuse me?
Why did Judge Rohr rule on it then?
Why did Judge Rohr rule on
good faith?
On good faith, because the good faith was raised initially. Then Judge Rohr ruled on that when he suppressed the warrant, finding that there could not be good faith. Judge Rohr felt that as a matter of law, he was required to address good faith in the motion to suppress hearing based on the facts presented. Based on those facts, he analyzed them, found that there couldn't be good faith because of the misrepresentations of the law enforcement officer, and he moved on. Moving on to the facts, the state wants to tell the court that there are no facts in this record. I would point out that there is a substantial amount of facts. There is a hearing testimony that goes on for some 60 pages. In this, the state wants to reject Uriah Tullis' testimony. Let's reject Uriah Tullis' testimony. Let's look at Tina Hall's testimony.
The judge rejected your client's testimony.
I disagree with that assessment. I believe Judge Rohr found that Uriah Tullis' testimony concerning the extent of his overnight stays was exaggerated, and that's what he rejected. And his letter makes clear that's what he disagreed with. He also made clear—
Is that letter in the record?
It's attached to the appendix. We requested it be included in the record, and I thought it was. I don't have my record here, so I can't tell you for sure.
Do the findings of fact include it or refer to it?
Again, I can't tell you because I'm not familiar with that. I can tell you the testimony of Tina Hall, the state's witness, the witness proffered by the state, the witness that the state says she's the one that the judge believed, states, Uriah Tullis and Brad Hall are good friends? Yes, they are. This is page 34 of the hearing record. Yes, they are. Are they best friends? I don't know. Do they spend a lot of time together? Yeah, they did, yeah. Spend quite a bit of time together. She goes on to say, Brad has so many friends that he spends time with. I can't really say that Brad was with him all the time. A question, you call him Bubba? Is that a nickname? That's what Brad calls him. So Brad and him are on a nickname basis. Yeah, I guess I've always known him as Bubba. Okay, this is clearly a long-standing relationship. How long have you known Uriah Tullis? A long time. We used to live by each other 10, 11 years. Clearly, this is not an earlier or short-term relationship. Uriah Tullis and Brad Hall have been friends all that time? Yes, going to page 35 of the transcript. This is Tina Hall's testimony. These are facts in the record in which the court can rely. They've been good friends all this time? Yes. Could Brad Hall or Uriah have stayed overnight? If you know, yes, he could have. This is Tina Hall's testimony. Did Uriah often eat meals over there? I'm not aware of that. Jody mentioned a couple of times he ate over there. Clearly, this is not an insubstantial contact.
Did she talk about the key?
She did not talk about the key. Uriah Tullis testified that he knew the location of the key. Brad Hall had told him where the key was in order to get in and out if he wanted to come and go as he pleased. Uriah was somewhat of a transient during this time. He spent time with friends more than anybody else, and he didn't have a car, so he could come and go as he pleased, but he couldn't get there unless somebody gave him a ride. So usually it was Brad Hall that brought him to the house.
Even disregarding your client's testimony, if we were to find standing, what do you see as the bright line here that this court could state as the bright line of where standing is supported and where it is not? What is there something about these facts that would lead us to say that under these facts, because of whatever it is that exists here, that now standing is established so that we could give direction to the trial courts?
I don't know that this case gets to the far end of that parameter. Clearly, there was a substantial connection between the host and the guest. Based on a substantial connection, I believe the federal courts have all ruled consistently standing applies. There is an expectation of privacy. I personally feel that the line should be drawn if they're on the premises with permission, that they should have Fourth Amendment rights. Fourth Amendment rights should not be so nebulous as to float away just because we happen to go over for a Super Bowl party, as opposed to go over to play cards, as opposed to go over just to say, hi, can I borrow a cup of sugar? That's not the way people act in our society, and that shouldn't be the way the Fourth Amendment acts in our society. It shouldn't be this nebulous cloud that can only follow you in the door under certain occasions. That personally is where I believe the bright line should fall. Beyond that, the expediency factor of law enforcement shouldn't obviate the need for Fourth Amendment protections. Our nation is founded on certain bedrock principles. In fact, our founders were so concerned about government infringing upon these bedrock principles that they required, as a condition precedent to going forth with this glorious experiment in democracy, that these principles be engrafted on the Constitution in a Bill of Rights, preserved to the people. Just like any building we talk about today, if the foundation is not sound, the building cannot be sound. It will collapse eventually on itself. I would contend that it's only through diligent protection of these fundamental or foundational principles that our society can go forward and resist becoming a police state. It bears pointing out that the erosion of personal liberties is unfortunately fueled by the best of intentions. A sincere desire for law enforcement for law and order and to keep the people safe and secure provides an incentive to limit or do away with personal liberties. However, history has taught us of the fallacy of going down the road of doing away with personal liberties. This is a lesson I urge on the court today. It would be much easier, so much easier, in dealing with analysis of personal liberty cases if we only had to deal with the case of fundamental freedoms in the context of those who are innocent of any wrongdoing. The weighing and the balancing becomes much more simple. However, these types of cases don't make it to the court. The innocent whose rights are trodden upon go upon their way, feeling put upon, feeling infringed, but don't come to the court asking for line drawing. It is only those who have been accused of crimes who have sufficient motivation to endure the cost, the time, and the anguish to come before this court.
Your time has expired. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.